Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School for National Service and a genocide scholar. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to Nick Estes, Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, about his book, Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance, published by Verso in 2019. This is not the first time Nick has been interviewed for New Books Network. Ryan Tate previously interviewed Nick for New Books in the American West. For this interview, however, we will focus primarily on genocide, resistance, and survival. Nick, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have the opportunity to speak with you about your important book, especially in this moment in history. Before we get into it, though, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Yeah, The history behind this particular book came not just out of Standing Rock. I think it gets placed in that context, and that's really important. But it also just came from growing up in Chamberlain, South Dakota, you know, in my own homelands, but not having really access to the history of the area or the region or the Lakota and Dakota people who live on the river. And this book was really an effort to, you know, provide a history, an accessible history of the area, primarily for, you know, a younger generation of Native scholars, Native students, but also a general audience, and something that was accessible and readily available. So that was really the impetus behind the book. And I'll say this, that like it also comes out of a particular kind of tradition in my own family. Two of my grandfathers were authors. They both wrote the first histories of our tribe, the Lower Brule Sioux tribe, and I really think of it as an extenuation of, or an extension of what they accomplished as scholars themselves.
Very interesting. It's definitely a very accessible book. I, as a genocide studies scholar, of course, I was really interested in how you discussed the genocide of Indigenous peoples in North America, as well as their stories of resistance and survival, which certainly connects the long history to the present day. I wonder if I could ask, you know, would you consider, based on what I see on social media from you and from your book and your actions, would you consider yourself a scholar activist? And if so, what does that mean to you and the work that you do?
If I consider myself a scholar activist, then I would say those who are writing, anyone who's writing history is a scholar activist, because they're automatically participating in some kind of political, you know, I would just say that history is political, right? And, you know, for example, the current debate that's happening right now with monuments, and I'm sure we'll get into this later on in the interview, it's centered on how we understand history. And you can't ignore politics in how we understand history. So for example, someone might say, they might dismiss my, you know, book or my work as activist scholarship, but they might not dismiss somebody like, you know, Gary Cooper Anderson, who is writing, who's actively denying that genocide existed against Indigenous people, right? I would see him as a more activist scholarship, a scholar than myself, you know, and he's kind of gone head-to-head with a lot of indigenous studies scholars saying that genocide never happened here on this continent. There was a video of a famous UK scholar recently who said, you know, if genocide happened, if slavery was genocide, then why are there so many Africans in Africa, right? But he's not seen as a activist historian. But those two assumptions, that indigenous genocide didn't happen in the Americas, or at least in North America, or that genocide didn't happen in Africa, those are two highly charged political statements and positions that have implications in how we understand contemporary, you know, politics, especially when it comes to land claims. You know, like the land claims around the Black Hills, for example, are incredibly charged, because often the accusation made against Lakota people is that we are, you know, late arrivals. We have no like real, you know, longstanding historical relationship with the Black Hills. It's been a common trope among Western historians, specifically reading white sources very literally, and how they understand, you know, Lakota attachments to place, or there are specific relationships to certain place, and not understanding like the fluid kind of like relationships that we had, not just with the land itself, but with other people who lived on the land. So for example, it was told to me by Charmaine Whitefaced, who sits on the Black Hills Treaty Council. She herself is a master oral historian and knows many of these histories, not from reading books, but from listening to her ancestors participate in the generational tradition of passing down these histories. But she explained it to me this way. She said that when you look out on the plains, you see, you tend to see just one grass, right? But if you look really closely, you see many species of grass. And in some parts of the plains, you see more dominant species, and, you know, but that doesn't preclude the existence of other species of grass. And so the misunderstanding of this particular region is that Lakota people, you know, basically did what the United States would do later on, which was, you know, essentially, you know, be imperialist and kick all the other tribes out of the territory and then become the dominant one. I would say that there was multiple factors involved, and that you can't reduce it to, this kind of cultural relativism or moral relativism to say that all societies kind of tend towards expansionism and imperialist conquest, and Lakota people are no different. That's just that's an activist, you know, that's an activist assumption. It needs to be labeled as such if my work is being labeled as activist, because all I'm doing is I'm just telling the stories that Lakota people have been, you know, telling me since I was a child. That's the history that I've known. And many of the people who are writing these histories about us as being imperialists, they're not Lakota people. They don't know the language. They don't know the oral traditions. You wouldn't write a history on Russia without understanding the Russian language, you know, Russian culture, history, and, you know, their value system. But that's the assumption of many, you know, dominant Western historians, is to come in and say like they can become experts on our people, having oftentimes never visited the place, or maybe have visited a handful of times, but don't really know the country and the nation itself. So that's what I would say to that, that accusation of, it's not really an accusation, the label of activist scholar. I don't call myself an activist scholar, but I don't like also, you know, just say that like scholarship isn't political or doesn't have a political agenda.
Yeah. When I asked the question, I was thinking of the activist scholar or scholar activist in a more positive light, but I totally understand, what you're saying about how some things that are labeled as activist scholarship can be devalued or trivialized. You know, I think it's similar to something that I've said before, which is that, you know, I say this to students sometimes when I introduce them to material they may not normally get introduced to, is that it's always labeled, or it seems to be labeled political when we introduce, you know, or certain scholarship is political, but we never look at the status quo scholarship or scholarship that, you know, reproduces the status right. quo as being political. But there's a political decision made in producing that kind of scholarship as well. But we don't always label it as such. So,
Well, if there is like something that you can take away from the term activist scholarship or activist scholar, it's that there's much more of a, how would you say, scrutiny towards what would be considered activist scholarship, because you have, you know, your peer review, right, in the academic institution itself. But then oftentimes the work that you use is often like reviewed by courts or by, you know, sometimes, you know, police, or it goes into some kind of like, you know, system that's outside of the academy to be judged by a different set of standards. And so in that sense, activist scholarship or the scholarship that I'm doing has to be more rigorous or, you know, has a different kind of set of eyes to, you know, determine its validity. And so in that sense, like I know people who are working on like a mega dam projects in places like Guatemala, where they can't, you know, they're very mindful of the fact that anything that they do is probably going to be interpreted or looked at or scrutinized by the court itself. And so there's always a mind towards that. And so in that sense, it raises the bar of, you know, the scrutiny and, you know, the level or the quality of the scholarship that's being produced.
Absolutely. I mean, there are gatekeepers, right? So before we get, you know, too off track from, you know, the bigger conversation here, because I'm sure we could continue to talk about this for the rest of the time. Getting back to your book, you've already sort of introduced the debate, if we want to call it that, around the genocide question of indigenous peoples. And, you know, throughout your book, you use the term genocide to describe the treatment of indigenous peoples. You also demonstrate how this treatment fits within the Genocide Convention, the legal definition from the murder of indigenous peoples to forced sterilization, creating conditions unsustainable to life, the forced transfer of children, you know, the boarding schools, you know, all these different sort of, you know, methods of that fall under the Genocide Convention. You know, for our audience, can you talk for a little bit more anyway about why this is genocide and how those who reject it do so, or how they justified rejecting the label of genocide?
Sure. So I think it's important to think about the 1977 Geneva meeting that was facilitated by a lot of indigenous organizations throughout the world at the United Nations, where they wanted to adopt how they understood genocide against indigenous people. And it's really important because it becomes a framework on how we view the past. And it's not to say, you know, there's an accusation, oh, the term genocide is a recent invention and you're applying it to the past, and so therefore it doesn't matter. But if you look at a lot of the claims of genocide, you know, throughout indigenous history, you begin to see a different kind of picture, because indigenous people have been saying this or has been making this accusation for quite some time. I can think of, you know, Zinkala Shah, whose birth name was Gertrude Bonham, but she, you know, she became a very prominent scholar and Native American rights activist in the early 20th century, and was very influential in an organization called the Society of American Indians, which was, you know, billed as the first kind of pan-indigenous North American society. But she has a piece that was unpublished called The Black Hills Claim, where she details the mass starvation of Lakota and Dakota people to get them to sign the Black Hills Agreement, and how they were coerced in, you know, in 1876 and 1877 to make these concessions to the United States government, how the mass slaughter of the buffalo had been kind of facilitated, and then later on how children, you know, were taken from their families and adopted and removed, you know, to oftentimes to off reservation boarding schools such as Carlisle in 1879. And so these accusations have existed for quite some time. And she wrote that piece, I believe, in 1921, and it was never published. So just for the Ocheti Shalkoi, that kind of exists in our consciousness, and claims that were made, you know, against the United States. And so when we talk about the Genocide Convention, it just really spells out things that we have already experienced and have already known in our own history. And the reason why it's genocide, and I think this is something that, you know, like if you just look at some of my Twitter posts, or even some of the Twitter posts online, when you do start talking about genocide in a more public venue, people, you know, will say, well, oh, well, you know, you still live here, you know, how is this genocide if we, you know, if you're not all dead? And it almost seems like genocide has to be the zero sum game, right? You either exist or you don't exist, right? And genocide happens if you don't exist, or if it's destroyed like a large part of your population. And the common misconception, I guess, in North America is that genocide is primarily the result of the act of killing, like kind of this idea that there was this warfare, this war of attrition, you know, where, you know, indigenous people were being killed in mass in these large scale massacres. And large scale massacres did happen, but they weren't the primary mode of killing. And I think that's what we actually have to talk about, like how indigenous people died. And, you know, now is the perfect time to talk about how we understand communicable diseases and why certain populations or certain people or demographics have higher, you know, what they call, you know, to use medical terminology, higher comorbidities or, you know, things that are called pre-existing conditions, right? And so that makes them more susceptible in this kind of medical terminology to not just rates of infection of things like coronavirus, but also dying from coronavirus. So in this state, in New Mexico, where I'm calling you from, I believe the death rate or the deaths, Native Americans account for around 50 to 52% of coronavirus deaths in the state, yet only make up about 11% of the population. So that's five times higher than their population. And why is that? The kind of traditional view, views that have been popularized by people such as Jared Diamond, Richard White, even Colin Calloway, is that there was a kind of immune deficiency there's a biological reason why so many indigenous people died of communicable diseases. And this gets into the virgin soil, you know, or the virgin soil thesis about disease, that indigenous people just had no natural immunity to these diseases that had developed in Europe, and Europeans had more kind of like fortitude biologically, right? That's the story we're told. And it's a very convenient narrative because it kind of lets, you know, these colonizing nations off the hook. And this isn't something I really get into the book so much. I get into it a little bit around in the chapters on the fur trade, because that was when disease was most devastating, not just for Lakota and Dakota people, but for the Missouri River indigenous nations in general. And the kind of heightened conditions of war and warfare around the river trade had created, you know, conditions where people weren't getting enough food, and therefore were becoming more susceptible specifically to diseases such as smallpox. And so if we understand the kind of pre-existing conditions as being created by invasion and colonialism with the intent to wipe out these indigenous nations, then it raises the question that disease is a tool of genocide. And it's not this kind of like, there, you know, the kind of other extreme version of this argument is that, like, well, it was, you know, disease was purposely spread amongst indigenous people. And that itself is also kind of a myth, even though it did happen in certain circumstances. It wasn't how most indigenous people contracted these viruses and these diseases, right? They often contracted it through trade, but it was made more deadly because of the conditions of war. And so when your food source is being taken away from you, when you're being confined to a certain, geography, and you're not allowed to leave, and you have the quote unquote pre-existing conditions of malnutrition, for example, it's going to cause higher rates of death. And so it changes how we understand genocide, in the sense that genocide, first of all, you know, requires intent. And I guess the definition would be like, you know, the conspiracy to commit genocide, I think is the actual language, or the incitement to commit genocide, or an attempt, right? Or sometimes even the complicity. And those things are important because it's about intent. It's not about outcome. It's about intent, right? And so the outcome may not have been the mass annihilation of indigenous people, And it was, if you, for the most part, especially if you track disease, I think around they attribute the more kind of accurate numbers attribute around 70% of the demographic decline as attributable to disease itself, which is huge if you think about it. And then, you know, warfare and other factors factor into that as well. But it was around in some instances around a 90% population decline, right? So genocide actually raises some frameworks that we can look at history with, right? So, you know, you name them in the question, right? But I'll just name them for people who want to listen or who are listening. You know, killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. That's the key language, right? Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And this is important because it doesn't have to include all of those things, right? It can include one or several of those things. And that's why it's an important tool to begin to study indigenous history specifically.
Of course, Nick, it's also, that is the legal definition, which is a political definition, which excludes, other than the transfer of children, excludes all other elements of cultural right. genocide, if we want to refer to that, just to differentiate here for our purposes, which was included in the earlier drafts and, of course, was included in Raphael Lemkin's conception of genocide. And there were so many things, you know, historically and ongoing that, you know, essentially seek to erase the indigenous identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's a really good question. And you and I might have different views on this, and you yourself are an expert on this. And so I would defer to you, but I will say, you know, I will say that we actually have to think about what culture means, right? In some ways, when we talk about culture for Native people, it takes on a different connotation than if we talk about culture from, you know, other folks. Culture arises from how, you know, one reproduces themselves, both biologically as well as socially. And, you know, that social reproduction is incredibly important because it includes, you know, our entire culture as, like, you know, Plains people was a buffalo culture. You know, it was to that specific region. And so our culture was tied to, you know, to use a Marxist framework, tied to a mode of production. And when you eliminate that economic and social mode of production, it's also part of eliminating that culture as well. And so culture isn't just this kind of immaterial thing. It's tied to a material basis, right? Of food, of life ways, right? So I would say that, like, you have to include culture and like language, you know, language is tied, you know, that language, our language evolved from our relationship to a specific place and to specific beings on that place, not just human beings, but other than human beings as well, including the buffalo and the animal and plant nations that live there. So yeah, culture should be included in that definition.
Thank you. Yeah. I know there's something I wanted to get to later. So I'll just add to it. See if there's anything else you want to say about this. You know, as you know, you indicated there, sometimes we think about genocide as, you know, a specific, there's like specific methods that can be separated from one another. But for indigenous peoples, you know, say physical, biological, and cultural survival are often interconnected, if not always interconnected. So, and you mentioned the extermination of buffalo and how, you know, that impacted indigenous peoples. Could you talk a little bit more how genocide might be seen as a sort of a holistic act that attacks indigenous peoples from, you know, various directions?
Right. So I think the most common, especially amongst indigenous people and indigenous history historians, is to think about the effect of the boarding schools, right? So we can look at the very basic definition of genocide, and which is forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And child removal is part of boarding schools, right? The legacies of child removal began primarily, I guess, or at least predominantly, with the off-reservation boarding school system that was created by Colonel Pratt. And his, you know, famous phrase was "kill the Indian, save the man." And we can understand that, like, it's not just those schools didn't just intend, like, you know, that there were a lot of children who died there. I think that's important to point out. A lot of people don't realize this, but those schools were never meant for education. The half the class that went there, and those were the first class that went there, was actually Lakota people themselves, primarily from Spotted Tail and Red Clouds bands and the Pine Ridge Agency and the Rosebud Agency. And they were taken, you know, to basically force those leaders to sign over more land concessions, right? And to adopt, you know, allotment later on after you know, the Dawes Allotment Act was passed. And so they were using these children as hostage. And, you know, that's the kind of like the kind of definition of genocide in that sense. And, you know, it's trying to achieve political ends by getting land sessions out of Lakota people and these two defiant, more kind of defiant bands of the Lakotas. However, the other aspect of it, and the aspect that you're talking about, this holistic idea of genocide is, you know, affecting the biological cultural. When they took those children there, they shaved their heads, right? They basically attempted to strip them of their indigenous identity. And while many did die, because of the harsh conditions of these boarding schools. And if we can just look at Carlisle, half of the class, the first incoming class died at Carlisle, right? Or they died, you know, on these outing programs where they would basically send children out to work for white families for free. So the first class of, you know, Carlisle, most of them didn't even graduate. I don't even know what the graduation rate was. But I haven't found that, you know, besides like Luther Standing Bear, who writes about this particular era, I haven't found very many instances of that first class graduating, let alone surviving, right? But they were stripped of their identity. They were, you know, their hair was cut. And for Lakota people, to cut one's hair actually means to mourn a death. And in Luther Standing Bear's autobiography of this particular era, he was part of that first generation. He basically like mourned the death of himself and the loss of his Lakota identity, or at least he didn't lose his identity. The identity itself was being taken from him. And he had to, you know, after his hair was cut, he had to point, you know, a pointer on a chalkboard to an arbitrary, you know, English name. And that's how he got Luther, right? And he talks about this in his book, My People, the Sioux, and also The Land of the Spotted Eagle, which I recommend people go and read, because it's often not thought of as, you know, something that's detailing genocide. And in fact, it is. You know, he does everything he's supposed to do. He goes back to the reservation. He gets his allotment. He tries to farm, but nothing really works out towards the end of his life, he becomes very critical of this whole, you know, this whole educational process. And he sees it as basically trying to turn indigenous people into white people. It's a form of genocide. He doesn't use that language because that language didn't really exist at the time. But that's his assessment. That's his conclusion. And this was in the 1930s when he was, you know, when he was writing his autobiographies. And so when we talk about, you know, the cultural aspect of genocide, I don't know if it's appropriate sometimes to call it cultural genocide, because I would say that it fits in with a broader framework of genocide. It's an aspect. I don't know if, you know, again, you and I may disagree on this, but you know, like that's how I see it. I see it as kind of part and parcel to a larger process, because while he was being stripped of his identity, you know, many of those children were returning home back to their families. And they had no means of communicating. They couldn't even speak with their parents, right? Because they no longer spoke the same language. And it broke those bonds of kinship, which were at the heart of, you know, all of our tribal societies. And when we talk about the repercussions of this, we can fast forward to 1969, when at that particular moment in time, one out of every three Native American children in the United States had been adopted out to a white family, right? Again, breaking that kinship tie, because that kinship tie is bound to the land itself, right? When you don't have that connection to your own family, you don't have that connection to your, to the land base itself, right? And then it makes it easier for that land to become a commodity. And I'm kind of going beyond the scope of my book here, but I did write a piece recently based on an interview I had conducted with one of my grandfathers, Frank Estes. And, you know, I talk about his work in the book itself, but it was like a footnote that became a kind of separate article. But he talked about, you know, he was a trained sociologist who went to South Dakota State University, and he was very interested in the idea of mobility and movement and how Lakota people, and primarily the Lower Brule, the Kulichash Oyate, the tribe that I belong to, were people of movement, and that we've always been dynamic in that sense. And it was the reservation, you know, system actually introduced a foreign system to us of being like, you know, sedentary and being, you know, confined to a reservation, and how, you know, foreign that was to us as Indigenous people, and how it also changed how we viewed our relationships with each other as, you know, as family. And he said this thing to me, and I thought, you know, at the time I was like, oh, wow, he's imparting some like Lakota wisdom on me. But he said, you know, we are related through the land. And I was like, wow, that's really profound. And he said, no, we can actually trace our relations through the land because of the Dawes Allotment Act and the parceling of land and the airship process that happened, right? So he pulled out a big stack of papers from the Department of Interior and showed me all the fractionated interests in one parcel of land in Wombly, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, where we have family. And I had no idea that we actually had family there. And he, you know, his estimation was, you know, because he's a sociologist and he was reading like Durkheim and all these other, you know, sociologists. And he said, you know, the world of like Indigenous relations has been replaced by a world of paper and has been abstracted. And I would say that that is an outcome of, you know, this cultural genocide that we have, that before our relationships, like he even talked about how a lot of the people we have that we knew as relatives and that I grew up knowing as relatives have no biological relationship to us whatsoever. We can't trace a common ancestor, but they were adopted into our family because that was the way that kinship structures worked. It wasn't based on blood. It wasn't based on blood quantum. And how it create, and even like, you know, even this original allotment had so many different heirs. And he said, you know, because the original family, you know, was polygamous, it was, and you know, that word I don't think is really applicable to our societies, because we never really had the kind of formal heteronuclear Christian, you know, structure of a family and marriage, or the institution of marriage that was premised on property. But this man, for lack of, you know, a better term, had three wives, and you know, like one of our ancestors was one of those wives. So all of that was kind of like kept on that piece of paper, that allotment paper that tracked these heirs and these fractionated interests. But I thought it was a very poetic way of understanding that the world of Indigenous relations, they attempted to replace them with the world of paper to abstract them, right? Whether it was through the form of writing and how writing was introduced to us. He talked about my grandmother, Cornelia Shawala, who's also talked about in the book, and how she learned English and how she came to learn to read and write. And it was through boarding school, right? And my great-grandfather, Ruben Estes, who I also talk about in the book, you know, he was bilingual. He was a translator. He could speak Lakota and English very fluently. They called him Ieska, which means to translate. Now it's, you know, it's kind of a derogatory term. It means mixed blood, which isn't quite accurate because Ieska means to speak and Ska means white, to speak white. But anyways, he couldn't read and write, but my grandmother, my great grandmother, Cornelia Shawala, where we get our clan name from, could read and write. And so she was writing all of these powerful congressmen, these lawyers, because my grandfather Ruben was the chairman, the first chairman of the tribe at the time. But I would just think of, like, you know, him sitting there in his rocking chair in his tar paper house on the Missouri River, like listening to, you know, my grandmother read the news, read these letters from these, you know, these high powered officials, these congressmen, even sometimes a president, or the the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. And then she would write out the letters, you know, to these guys, and they probably had no idea that this woman was the one who was actually communicating with them. So that's the world of paper. You know, that's a really long answer to your question. But I think it can be detailed more through our stories as Lakota and Dakota people than it can be like in a kind of academic sense that way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know that we disagree that much. I think it's really another part of which would be a whole other conversation about genocide studies and how a lot of the definitions still being used in genocide studies basically require that substantial numbers of people be killed through direct physical violence. And so then I think some of us feel like we have to refer to quote unquote cultural genocide to draw attention to these other acts that constitute genocide. But then of course, when we refer to cultural genocide, then we're sort of saying that it is something different rather than a part of genocide, which gets into, you know, complicated things around around genocide studies scholarship. I wanted to go back a little bit to the debate about genocide. You talk a little bit about founding myths in your book, and so I wanted to, you know, maybe a couple questions that relate to the debate, but taking it a step forward to the question of denial. There's been movements against denial of genocides, including legislation that criminalizes denial of genocide. Some of the ones that I can think of include, the Armenian genocide, the Jewish Holocaust, and the Tutsi genocide in Rwanda. Interest of mine is we don't treat our lack of recognition, if you will, of some other genocides, including indigenous genocides, as denial. And in my mind, failure to recognize the indigenous people, genocide of indigenous peoples, can be seen as a form of denial. And I was wondering, you know, maybe especially in the North American context, how founding myths maybe contribute to why it's not seen as denying genocide, and any thoughts you have on any of that.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. I mean, you can just look at how the ideas of the, if you go back to the pilgrims, they saw the diseases and that were exacerbated by the conditions of war, that were introduced to indigenous people in those areas in New England specifically, and what became New England, were seen as divine intervention, right? To basically clear the land. And so the kind of founding ideology is this idea that this land, you know, belongs to this new nation that's being created. You know, John Winthrop's, you know, city on a hill where the rest of the world will look and gaze upon, you know, the city that's, you know, this, that has this exceptional, unique history. And so the denial of indigenous genocide is tied to these kind of, you know, founding myths before even the United States came into existence as a nation, right? Because the U.S. later on, you know, draws from the pilgrim mythology specifically as something that's foundational to its nationhood and the exceptionalism of this particular state. And, you know, that gets into these ideas of like, you know, biological inferiority, you know, the kind of religious or spiritual or social cultural inferiority of indigenous people being unable to cope with the advanced kind of technology that was introduced, all of these things, it makes for a convenient story to just say that because of these natural conditions, because of social evolution, because of biological evolution, indigenous people, just couldn't, they weren't strong enough to fight back. So they kind of withered away and died off, and those are what, Michael Wilcox, a Native American archaeologist calls terminal narratives, right? And terminal narratives has like multiple definitions. One of them is just the academic obsession with the die-off narratives, right? If you look at like some of the language that's used by popular academics, Western historians, just to, and it's not just like Colin Calloway and Richard White who say this, a lot of people repeat these narratives, but they're kind of the two most turned to Western historians or indigenous historians. So it's worth pointing them out because people might be familiar with them, but both of them on multiple occasions say that indigenous people were quote unquote doomed to die. Right. And that has to do primarily with the disease narratives. And so the founding myths of this country are kind of, they've evolved over time. Right. So with the pilgrims, it was divine intervention. God cleared this land, for his chosen people. Right. And then later on, it became, they became more quote unquote scientific explanations for why the land was cleared. And you can't really penetrate either of those arguments with the question of genocide, right? Because it doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't fit, the idea that like if people are just naturally inferior and they die off, that's not genocide. That's just nature, right? That's just like this idea of a mechanical nature, right? That just nature is taking its course. So it's hard. It's hard to penetrate either one of those myths. And the thing that I have learned the most about this is actually from museum studies. Everyone should go read Decolonizing Museums by Amy Lone Tree, and just having conversations with her about how genocide is erased. Indigenous genocide specifically is erased in U.S. museums, but also even how like indigenous museums tend to obfuscate genocide. There are more museums to the Shoah, the European Shoah, than there are to the indigenous genocide in North America. And we have to ask ourselves, why is that? Why? It's not to say that, we shouldn't memorialize and recognize the Shoah and learn from that those atrocities. We absolutely should. But why is it that the Shoah becomes, what the genocide that the United States is comfortable remembering, but not the indigenous genocide, right? And I think we, in several of her articles and books, she kind of details like the National Museum of the American Indians, and even how that became controversial. Like it's on the National Mall. It's part of the series of museums, and it's not really close, but it's nearby. Like I remember whenever I go to Washington, D.C., I love going to all the museums. I went to the African American History Museum, which is amazing. They have a whole series on, the history of slavery and lynching. And you walk out of those exhibits and you're like, wow, this is the history. These are the modern legacies, right? You go to the Holocaust Museum and there's, you don't have a doubt in your mind of the pure horror, right? And the legacy of the Shoah, right? But then you walk into the Museum of the National Museum of American Indians. And I haven't been recently. I went several years ago, but they used to have this exhibit that kind of tried to explain the conquest of the Americas from an indigenous perspective. And I walked in there and I was like, it was just, it didn't make any sense. There was no narrative. There wasn't a coherent narrative. I walked out and I didn't feel as if like even as an indigenous person that it like really spoke to like, indigenous, like there was an indigenous genocide. And it doesn't mean that you have to go to those museums and just have like that kind of sinking feeling, but at least they should talk about it and they should like explain to the public. It's their duty to explain to the public. And I thought to myself, I was like, why is that? Like, why is it? Why can't we have the recognition of, this kind of genocide. And I think it's difficult, like even with indigenous controlled museums, it's difficult to have that conversation because the broader public isn't, you know, ready to have that conversation. I mean, I wouldn't say like the broader public. I think if most people knew and learned about indigenous genocide, we would have a definite cultural and political shift in this country. But I think there's a currency to deny genocide in this country because indigenous genocide is directly tied to land, right? That's why we talk about settler colonialism and the elimination of the native. Because when we begin to talk about indigenous genocide and possible, restoration or justice, it broaches the question of land. Like, how was this land acquired? How did 95% of privately owned land in the United States fall into the hand of white families, right? How did one in four of, every adult white American alive today benefit directly from the 1862 Homestead Act? How did, the Morrill Act, in which, was passed in 1862 under Abraham Lincoln, how this act facilitated the wealth of land grant universities in this country that actually that categorically excluded indigenous peoples and African Americans at the time? How did the modern university in the United States get created to create, some of the most advanced academic and educational systems in the world? It happened at the expense of indigenous people, right? And so it raises these moral questions about how the land was taken and for what purposes it was taken, right? And so it's difficult to have that conversation. Even now it's like, with the destruction of monuments and the taking down of monuments, people are suggesting, well, why don't we just put up, why don't we just put up a memorial for like native people alongside of, these monuments? And I was, and when people ask me that question, I'm like, well, that already exists. They're like, well, what do you mean? And I was like, well, it's like you have Crazy Horse Memorial Monument in the Black Hills just down the road from Mount Rushmore. And I said, but the conditions still remain the same, is that both of those memorials, both of those monuments exist on stolen Lakota land, right? In the heart of our cosmological and spiritual universe. It doesn't actually shift and it doesn't actually change the material conditions. And that's when, that's what I think like the larger question of indigenous genocide really brings about, is it actually brings in, it calls into question the very existence of the United States and its founding myths as well.
Yeah, which is a much deeper and significant discussion than I think most want to have. because the only conclusion you can come to, I mean, obviously the fairest thing would be, well, I mean, a couple of things. Land could be returned, but that's right. Not even open for any discussion at all, at least in a legal sense. It also makes us think about our family's entire history. Me as a someone with a European ancestry. There's another thing I was going to say there, but I lost track for a moment. I guess maybe I want to ask you a little bit about the toppling of statues and symbols of, our racist and violent history in this country. I mean, is it more than symbolic? Is there something happening there besides just removing these symbols? But also, are there any statues? I talked with Jeffrey Osler about his book, and he talks about Thomas Jefferson. Of course, a prominent monument in the DC area. Are these worthy of being torn down also or replaced? And I guess maybe does it matter?
Yeah, I think, those are important questions. I'm not like, it's like a question of like for or against, like tearing down monuments. The question for me is that like right now we have armed guards who are sitting around these monument protecting them 24/7, right? That to me says a lot about the moral, political, and you know, social and cultural investments in these, in this, in these kinds of narratives. The, you know, to get really simple, you know, colonization is about three things. It's about God, gold, and glory. And the, you know, they brought the God, you know, there's a joke. And I found out this is a joke in South Africa as well. Some of my South African friends shared it with me, but they said, you know, when white people came, or when Europeans came, they brought the Bible and we had all the land. And now we have the Bible and they have all the land, right? And the gold, there's the kind of economic, you know, side of colonization. It doesn't just happen because they hate our culture and our spirituality. There's economic, you know, there's an economic base to it, right? And if you even look at the Black Hills, you know, the reason why the Black Hills were taken from us is because of its rich gold veins. And then there's the glory part, right? And this is the soft underbelly of it all, I believe, is that because this is what's evoking the most, you know, violent confrontations. Like, we can stop the economic, you know, flow of capital, you know, by blockading pipelines and, you know, all across the country. We can shut down, you know, rail lines in Canada and all these things and raise all this attention. We can, you know, we can stop the flow of capital. And, you know, people start paying attention and, you know, there is, of course, state backlash and everything's like that and everything like that. But what has, you know, evoked the most violent backlash is the glory part. The question of these monuments, like here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, there was an Oñate monument, Donde Oñate. He was a Spanish conquistador. He himself had an indigenous mother that was, you know, he was a product of rape. But he, you know, was a very violent individual. He was a mutilator. He was a genocider, and he himself was a rapist and, you know, did awful things to the Pueblo people in this region. And out of all of the things that I've seen in this city around, you know, police violence, specifically against indigenous people, border town violence, it was the statue, the taking down of the statue that actually resulted in the shooting of somebody, like a white vigilante shooting into a crowd of people and shooting one individual, another white person, but who was defending this crowd of people, shot him three times in the back. And to me, that says something, you know, that this is the soft underbelly and the weakest foundation of this kind of settler narrative. It's not just these statues, it's the glory part, right? They want to make, there's such a deep moral, political, and, you know, emotional investment in these kinds of things that people are willing to kill other people to keep them up, right? And that, to me, you know, is really at the heart of all of this in the statues. I'm not going to like advocate for the tearing down of statues. People have very good reasons for taking down these statues, and it's incumbent upon us as people who our social commenters, as historians, to actually listen to what they're saying, because the histories that they're telling are very complicated, right? There's, you know, why take down Grant? If you listen to the people who took down the Grant statue, or at least the people in the community who took down the Grant statue, they talk about Ulysses S. Grant as an Indian killer, right? And a slave owner. And he wasn't invested in abolition, and they're telling the story, you know, and you actually have to listen to what people have to say. Right. And I think that's the outcome of all of this. And it can't be simplified by one kind of historical moment in time, such as the Civil War, as defining the morality of this country, because even the Civil War, as we understand it in popular, you know, in kind of popular history, or the popular understanding of the Civil War, is that yes, the Civil War was fought to end slavery, but it only became a war for slavery when African people themselves began to fight for their freedom, right? It wasn't, the Union never entered that war with the objective of freeing enslaved African people, right? And so that's also a, you know, convenient elision. And also the fact that the Civil War was used as an opportunity by the Union Army to shore up its western frontier by committing, you know, horrific acts of violence against indigenous people. And this, the toppling of these statues has created a national conversation and an international conversation, you know, because they're doing it in London and they're doing it in Belgium, you know, all over where these statues exist. But it's created this conversation to actually begin to investigate history and to really, you know, go at the root of these founding myths and why there is so much, you know, invested in sustaining these statues themselves. And so I think the statue question is important, and we have, you know, we have to understand that, like, the Confederate statues were erected during, you know, Jim Crow as a part of like a broader campaign of racial terror to remind Black people, you know, that the South will rise again, right? And these statues to Columbus, you know, Columbus never even stepped foot on what became the United States. I don't understand the obsession with Columbus, right? And there was this is a kind of a funny aside, but I saw Columbus, Ohio removed, you know, this kind of gets to the absurdity of it all, but Columbus, Ohio removed its Columbus statue, but kept the name Columbus, Ohio, which I thought was really funny. Cause I was like,
that's too far.
Yeah. But it's, I do think that the question of these monuments is important, and it does talk about, the history, you know, it's an opportunity for historians to weigh in and to really evaluate, but also it's an opportunity for people, everyday people, to democratically participate in the creation, the telling of their own history. And that, you know, that should be embraced. Only, you know, only people who don't understand history or have some kind of psychological or moral investment in the dispossession of Indigenous people and African American people, are invested in these kinds of things. And, you know, it's revealing the deep fissures in this that have always existed in this country.
And, you know, there's reasons why I think things have come to a head as we sit here today. You know, a lot obviously tying to Trump administration policies. But yeah. In your book, you also write about the Obama administration. And, you know, I was wondering, you know, obviously there's been Republicans in office, there's been Democrats in office, and the threat to Indigenous peoples continues. So I mean, is this threat non-political, or is it bipartisan one? You also, of course, talk about capitalism, and of course, both parties generally are advocates push, you know, or hold up capitalism as our economic model. So I don't know, is this more than just Trump? Is this something that's ingrained in American political and, you know, societal culture?
The primary organizing principle of a settler colonial society is the elimination of the native, right? And Indigenous scholars have been really good at elaborating on the native, not just as like some kind of, you know, disembodied like individual or whatever. It's not just a body. Like I don't like the term when people say, oh, native bodies or Black bodies. These are persons, but more importantly, Indigenous people have always represented a different political order, right? And so if the organizing principle of settler society, whether it's Democrat or Republican, is the elimination of Indigenous people, it puts out a different question, right, that we have to confront as historians. And it means that Indigenous, you know, left out of this question is like the idea of Indigenous governance. And we can see, you know, as the primarily First Nations people have really brought to our attention, the massive amount of resource extraction that Canada participates in, whether it's in the Alberta tar sands or, you know, the mining in the western part of the country or the dam building. Those are tied to extreme forms of gendered violence against primarily Indigenous women. And it's not just because Indigenous women, you know, are obstacles to capitalist accumulation, which they are, but it's because Indigenous women and primarily non-men represent an alternative political order. When Europeans first came, whether it was the British, the French, or the Spanish, and then later the American, Euro-Americans, when they entreated us and entered into trade relations, they refused to recognize the leadership of Indigenous women, even though many Indigenous societies were, you know, matriarchal, or didn't have the kind of the gendered antagonisms that were very dominant in, you know, heteropatriarchal Western or European societies. And so immediately their governance systems were targeted, not initially, they were just ignored and erased, right? To basically hold up indigenous men as leaders. And you can see this going on, you know, throughout history from the fur trade, right? It was, you know, fur traders weren't dealing with indigenous women as the brokers, right? Of the fur trade. It was primarily indigenous men, and it created antagonisms within indigenous society. They wouldn't allow indigenous women to, they meaning these, settler nations wouldn't allow indigenous women to sign treaties. But there's a good history of, Black Hawk. His autobiography talks about this when they sent military people into negotiate a treaty with the Sac and Fox, folks. He said, well, we don't control the land. It's, you know, indigenous are, it's the women's societies who, you know, are the agricultural, you know, they keep the corn, they keep the fields, all these things. You have to talk to them. And the general, the U.S. generals or the U.S. officers were so upset that they would send their women to talk with these generals. They just walked out of the treaty meeting because they refused to recognize indigenous women or indigenous non-men's authority. And so when we talk about settler society in this particular moment in time and the rise of consciousness around murdered and missing indigenous women, it's tied to this longer history of gendered violence. And that's happened under, you know, it doesn't matter who's in power, right? Like the Haudenosaunee Confederacy calls every sitting president town destroyer since Washington, right? And so there's that kind of antagonistic relationship. And when we look at somebody like Obama was, you know, responsible for the policy of energy, American energy independence, right? We will pursue all avenues of green technologies or sustainable technologies such as wind and solar, alongside of developing, you know, the national energy infrastructures around oil and gas and the fossil fuel economy. And under Obama's administration, I believe domestic oil production increased by 80%, right?
In Cushing, Oklahoma, he gave a maybe understudied speech where he talked about how more pipeline had been laid under his administration than any previous one.
Exactly, right? And so he I wouldn't say that he was like directly responsible, but he certainly didn't stand in the way of what we now call the fracking revolution, right? And it happened about the same time as the financial crisis or the Great Recession. And it was seen as like one of the, you know, the primary kind of driving economic forces that pulled the U.S. economy out of the gutter following that. And so it was part of the recovery process, right? Investing in domestic oil production and the fossil fuel economy. So under Trump, you know, in the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, it's important to like recognize the limits of, you know, Obama's policy. So yeah, he approved like 3/4 of the legs of the Keystone XL pipeline. And that, I think that was actually at one of the pipeline, the ceremonies for that pipeline in Cushing, Oklahoma. But he wouldn't allow the crossing of the Keystone XL pipeline on an international border because it, you know, fell outside of his domestic energy policy, right? So the Dakota Access Pipeline that led to the Standing Rock Uprising was, you know, a domestic pipeline that was taking oil from the Bakken oil region and, you know, transporting it down to the Gulf of Mexico as part of this kind of longer infrastructure. And so he couldn't, you know, like we wish that he would have done more, but he didn't. And partially it's because it fell outside of his own. I mean, it was within line of his own policy, his domestic energy policy. And Trump comes along and, you know, advances or expands Obama's energy, American energy independence to talk about American energy dominance, right? Because under Obama really laid the foundation for the U.S. becoming an exporter, right, of oil. And Trump, you know, is now like using that or was using it. And it's not so much the case now, but was using that as like a, you know, a big stick to basically beat the rest of the world into submission because the U.S. was now kind of on top of the oil game for the first time in its history, at least since like the 1960s, right? It became an exporter nation and it is now the number one exporter in the world. I don't know what that number is now. It might be different. I don't really know because of the fall in oil prices, right? And so he did what Obama refused to do, and he fast-tracked the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline, which ironically took, 4 years for the Keystone XL pipeline to actually begin constructing its northern leg, and they're currently doing it right now. There's not a clear timeline, of when that will happen. But, it's important to remember that Obama had appointed like key native officials, right? The sister of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the chairman, Chairman Dave Archambault, his sister, Jody, was actually in the Obama administration, not during the Standing Rock uprising, but before. So there's no way that Obama didn't know about the Dakota Access Pipeline, because the Standing Rock Sioux tribe had been raising awareness around the pipeline itself since at least 2013. And there's no way that the tribe didn't have a direct communication with Obama, because he, came to the Flag Day ceremony, the Flag Day powwow and Cannonball, right, which is at the heart of the Standing Rock resistance, or the camps that were created in 2014, and met with Dave Archambault, the chairman at the time, as well as many of the children who went on, many of the youth, the Standing Rock youth that went on to, be brutalized by police forces in opposing the contamination of their water supply, the Missouri River. So that happened under Obama, right? I don't like the facile comparisons of who's worse, but they're operating under the same kind of structural framework of settler colonialism. There's a diminishment of sovereignty. The only difference between Obama and Trump is that Obama, took a track of that's very similar to maybe the Trudeau government in recognizing indigenous cultural rights, but not doing anything about really recognizing like sovereignty and territorial integrity of indigenous people or land itself, right? And that becomes the politics of recognition, whereas Trump isn't interested in any of that. He's not interested in recognizing indigenous people, their cultural rights. He's kind of more belligerent and outwardly racist, by, saying slurs such as, calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, who, she was a child victim of sex trafficking, right? Which is not funny to us as indigenous people. But she herself is, part of that kind of gendered violence of myth-making, right, with John Smith, like as if a child has any consent to marry a white man that's like more than twice her age, right? And these are the kind of examples. They're very extreme examples, I would say, because it operates at different levels, even on a local level. So you had somebody like Heidi Heitkamp, who was the senator, Democratic senator of South Dakota or North Dakota, at the time of the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and herself was pro-pipeline, right? And against the wishes of the tribe. But the tribe itself had overwhelmingly, within its voting district, voted for Heidi Heitkamp, right? Because she was a Democrat and she, she was strong on like in indigenous jurisdiction, but as well as, later on murder missing indigenous women. And so these are the realities that a lot of tribes confront, right? They may like vote for a Democratic, senator in North Dakota who is, pro oil and gas, which, leads to the destruction of their homelands. And, Heidi Heitkamp was actually personal friends with Trump. She actually flew on Air Force One with him from Washington, D.C. to North Dakota, where he gave a rally speech prior to or during the protests themselves. Those are the realities, between Democratic and Republican. And even in this state, New Mexico, where I'm calling from, it's primarily a Democratic state, but its economy is now being saturated with oil and gas. And most of the oil and gas is happening. A lot of the oil and gas is happening in the Four Corners region on the, you know, eastern side of the Navajo Nation, where they're pumping in millions of gallons of fresh water a day. And this is a high desert environment. You know, water is a precious resource. They're pumping it in a day, you know, next to home sites and Navajo Nation that don't even have access to running water, right? And the people who are living on that land don't even benefit from the extraction of oil from those land from those lands. And if you look at the history of resource development in this area, you can just drive on Highway 550 up towards Farmington from Albuquerque, and you can see the successive waves of resource colonization from the oil derricks, you know, that were built, the wooden oil derricks that were built in the 1920s, to the pump. The rotating pump oil derricks or oil pumps that were built in, I think, in the 50s. And then now you can see the modern fracking rigs that are built, you know, within the last 5 years here and have devastated the landscape and are infringing upon sacred sites, UNESCO, you know, World Heritage sites like Chaco Canyon and the Greater Chaco landscape.
Thank you, Nick. I know we've taken a lot of your time, but I do want to try and close this out with just a couple more questions, if you have time.
Sure.
The first, in your book, you know, I found it really interesting what you wrote about the threat to indigenous peoples, ending that threat, and your discussion of Ella Deloria. Can you talk about indigenous and Black solidarity historically and in the present?
Yeah, so I detail this a little bit in two chapters, the Red Power chapter as well as the internationalism chapter. And I think what stuck out to my mind was that W.E.B. Du Bois, who, you know, helped co-found the NAACP, was also instrumental in the formation of the Society of American Indians, the first kind of pan-Indigenous or pan-American Indian organization in the United States, which was founded in the early 1900s. And he was, you know, like they had a strict membership policy. You had to be American Indian to be a member, but he was the only non-American Indian or non-Indigenous person who had membership. And it was because he and Charles Eastman, Ohiesa, the famous medical physician who the Dakota medical physician who was born in, you know, a buffalo hide teepee, on the lam, so to speak, from the 1862 Dakota uprising and then, you know, the punitive campaigns that had happened afterwards. But he went on to get a medical degree, I think at Dartmouth, and had befriended Du Bois, who is, you know, a prominent figure in Black political thought and Black studies in this country. Civil rights, but as well as, you know, like anti-capitalist struggle. He later became, you know, a member of the Communist Party, I think for a year right before he died in the 1950s. But he and Eastman traveled together and actually spoke at the same, presented at the same session, the Congress of the Racial Congress in London. I can't remember the year off the top of my head. It was either 1911 or 1912. But they gave presentations that like were very complementary of each other, right? And Du Bois wasn't just thinking about, you know, when he made his famous thesis of like, you know, the problem of the color line, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, or like even the idea of the lighter or the darker nations of Europe and the rest of the world as being kind of the fundamental antagonism of modern history. He was thinking of indigenous people, you know. He didn't really write so much about it, but he had an alliance with, you know, with Zinkala Shaw and Charles Eastman, and both of them wrote of Du Bois, and it suggests that they had some kind of working relationship. And Du Bois' famous book, "The Soul of Black Folk," was also, you know, inspirational to Charles Eastman, "The Soul of the Indian," one of his first books that he published about contemporary indigenous rights. And so a lot of people trace Black Power back to somebody like Du Bois. And I would argue that you could trace Red Power back to, you know, the Society of American Indians and people like Zinkala Shaw and Eastman himself. And so those relationships existed, you know. The part of my forthcoming research is more like fleshing those relationships out, and what they actually meant, you know, the disjunctures, but also the confluences of thought and ideas, that they were developing at that time. But later on, you know, I don't really detail this in the book, but it's something that I'm working on in another project. The idea of Red Power came about, you know, just months after Kwame Ture, or, you know, also known as Stokely Carmichael, coined the term Black Power. Mel Tom and Clyde Warrior, two people who were foundational in creating the National Indian Youth Council in 1961, I believe it was, coined the term Red Power. And it wasn't seen as a competing kind of political framework of Black Power, but it was actually seen as complementary, and that Indigenous and Black people had encountered the United States as groups of people versus as individuals, right? Indigenous people as nations. Some would argue, you know, there's Black nationalism or Black peoplehood or African peoplehood. You know, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture himself was a Pan-Africanist, and Vindaloria would later write about his kind of admiration for somebody like Kwame Ture as being, you know, a nationalist. And it's not like race nationalism. I think people kind of mistake that as like a race nationalism, but it was based on a framework of peoplehood, right? Of shared ancestry, shared language, but also more importantly, the kind of shared history of oppression with the U.S. government. And so there was a lot of cross-pollination between the Black Power movement and the Red Power movement. If you read somebody's autobiography, like Asada Shakur, she was at Alcatraz in 1969 and was very influenced by the Indians of all nations and their takeover of the Alcatraz Island and attempting to create, you know, a university and like for indigenous people. Right. And she, you know, she asked like, well, what can I do? What can I do as an African person to help the indigenous cause? And they said, well, go back to Harlem and liberate Harlem. You know, it was kind of a joke, but she took it seriously, you know. And and also like Angela Davis, you know, she attempted to go to Wounded Knee during the occupation in 1973. But she herself, you know, if you read her work, she, you know, she was very influenced a lot by the Red Power movement of that time period. Dennis Banks and the Belcourt brothers, Vernon and Clyde, you know, when they were in jail and prison, they were reading about the Black Panther Party and the Black Power movement and were very much influenced by it and wanted to create their own organization. You know, it wasn't a clone, because it developed, you know, from the conditions of, you know, the struggles of everyday Native American people, like specifically off reservation, but it had those influences. And you can see that the same kind of collaboration and cross-pollination with like the immense amount of support that groups like Black Lives Matter provided for the Standing Rock Uprising in 2016. I remember leaving for Chicago to do research at the Newberry Library for a month at a fellowship. And as soon as I got off the plane, I went to the American Indian Center in Chicago. And the groups that were there were the American Indian Center community, as well as Black Lives Matter. And they were organizing solidarity, even sent delegations out to Standing Rock. And then with the George Floyd protests, there was the same kind of solidarity you had seen. You know, it was the American Indian Movement, also various indigenous organizations in the city were very supportive and integral to the uprising and the anti-police violence work in the city. So those connections run very deep. I would say run deeper than just those histories that I would say, you know, and that's part of a book project that I'm working on sometime in the future. I don't know when it's going to be completed, but tracing the origins of this country back to African and American Indian rebellions. You know, the first so-called maroon colonies, you know, the first settlement, the European settlement, I think it was in 1523, was overthrown. It was a Spanish, you know, attempt to colonize what is now South Carolina. They brought with them African, enslaved African people, as well as enslaved Caribbean indigenous people, to create a plantation in, you know, and make a foothold or a beachhead in South Carolina. And the African people and the the indigenous people from the Caribbean found a way to communicate with each other. And then they also found a way to communicate with the Guales, the people, the indigenous people of the area. And they coordinated a revolt and evicted the Spanish from, you know, the continent. And it was African people who were the first permanent residents in what later became the United States, you know, and they were taken in by the tribes and they developed real kinships, you know, with those tribes. And I think that's a much more productive story in a much earlier history, you know, of resistance and Black and Indigenous resistance specifically that we need to celebrate and we need to foreground before we can, you know, talk about the birth of the United States and all those other things.
Thanks, Nick. And that offers a good segue to my final question here. And it's about your last chapter titled Liberation. And to share a brief excerpt with our listeners, you wrote at the, you know, at the very end of your book, whereas past revolutionary struggles have strived for the emancipation of labor from capital, we are challenged not just to imagine, but to demand the emancipation of earth from capital. For the earth to live, capitalism must die. That's a big task. And I wonder if you can offer maybe our listeners any optimism and suggestions for how to contribute to that project.
Yeah, that's some of the work that I'm doing now. It's kind of been, you know, waylaid by the coronavirus and the inability to travel for very good reasons. I'm not complaining. but I've been doing work on like this idea of indigenous land defense and caretaking economies, because it's something that tends to fall outside of the formal kind of realm of, you know, workers versus capital, right? And it's not work that capital or capitalism recognizes as essential work, because therefore it's not paid, right? Indigenous land defenders are not paid to defend their land, nor are water protectors, but nonetheless, it's vital, right, for the biological and social reproduction of everyone on this planet. We all need clean water, clean air, right, and healthy land to live on, right? It's an essential requirement. Just as people need, you know, care work for elderly people, care work for children, you know, care work for the people who are sick, and that's often devalued in gendered labor, and it's not recognized. And so when I said, you know, emancipate the earth from capital, you know, it is the realm of, like, you know, workers versus capital, those who are in the wage economy, but it's also includes a much more expansive vision that Black feminists, you know, Marxists and leftist feminists, as well as indigenous people, have theorized that work isn't something that's just defined in relation to capital. You know, it is oftentimes defined that way, but when we say emancipate the earth from capital, we mean talking about indigenous land defense in places like the Amazon, or even in a city like Albuquerque, right? The protection of the waterways, the protection of the plant and, you know, traditional food systems and food sovereignty in the city is incredibly important. It's something that a lot of people don't really see as part of that broader work, but it is happening. The protection of bioregions, such as the Missouri River Basin, the protection of, you know, deserts. Deserts are often seen as lacking life, but in fact are, you know, integral to the biosphere of this country, but also the world. You know, you have a lot of wasting that happens in deserts. You have a lot of nuclear testing, the dumping of things in deserts. And, you know, I just say this because my friend, she's a Paiute anthropologist, Kristen Simmons, does a lot of work on this. And that's part of the myth of, you know, deserts, is that they're not populated with anybody and they're like, you know, they're not full of life, but they are, you know, indigenous people have been living that way with those things. And so when we talk about emancipating the earth from capital, we mean all forms of life. And this is something that I think is incredibly important and has been integral to like specifically an indigenous framework. And I turn to somebody like, you know, Lee Miracle, who, you know, talked about the end of the plundering of earth for profit. And, you know, it's been very prominent and specifically in indigenous feminism to understand like what you do to the earth, you also do to your bodies, or you do to the body of indigenous people or indigenous people's, you know, health. And that doesn't really fall within a lot of the frameworks, the kind of mainstream frameworks of how we understand anti-capitalism or alternatives to capitalism. But you can look at documents like the 2010, you know, Cochabamba Accords, or the People's Accords that were passed in Bolivia, where they talked about the rights of nature. And I think that's something that we need to really reflect on in this moment. You know, it was written over almost a decade, well, actually a decade ago. And it began this movement of, you know, granting rights of nature and protecting nature and understanding ecocide as a form of genocide, you know, in some ways. And this didn't come from like the big think tanks of the North. This didn't come from, you know, the kind of more prominent progressive movements, social movements in the North. It came from campesinos. It came from indigenous people. It came from, you know, the humble people of the earth who really advanced what we know as like eco-socialism or eco-feminism, or, you know, even indigenous, you know, frameworks of environmentalism to the foreground that the rest of the world is now following. You know, you have the rights of nature movement, you know, happening in places in the United States or in New Zealand, Aotearoa, and those origins actually came from Bolivia, and it came from these, you know, from indigenous people. And so I think we need to, you know, not be so arrogant in the first world and actually listen to other movements that are far more advanced in terms of how they're understanding, you know, justice and specifically climate justice and climate decolonization. Because, you know, right now it's, you know, like that framework that I said, you know, for the earth to live, capitalism must die. This kind of comes from like some, you know, Marxist schools of thought. The other one is, you know, they're saying, well, socialism or barbarism, you know, that's the alternative that we're facing right now with the rise of authoritarianism. Well, we say, not just me, I'm not the one that coined this phrase, but a lot of indigenous people say in the indigenous movement, since we're facing the sixth mass extinction event, and since, you know, we have less than, you know, a decade to drastically change course, in this moment in time, you know, it's decolonization or extinction. That's the reality that we're facing. And I think indigenous knowledges are at the forefront of foregrounding that, right? And it gets into the ideas of genocide. It gets into the ideas how culture, indigenous culture, plays a prominent role, especially since, you know, 80% of the world's biodiversity is in land controlled by or managed by or taken care of by indigenous people. And we have to recognize that, you know, some of this stuff, it's not easy. It's not easy work. You know, why is it easier to imagine the end of, you know, fossil fuel economy, but not settler colonialism? You know, that's a problem. But indigenous people have developed, you know, the most kind of robust frameworks of environmentalism and climate justice that we need to pay attention to. And yeah, I encourage everyone to go out and read, you know, the Just Transition Principles by Indigenous Environmental Network. My organization, the Red Nation, came out with a three-part policy program called the Red Deal. There's also the Cochabamba Accords. We drew a lot of inspiration from that. Those are the documents that indigenous people have been working on for generations, not just, you know, it's not a recent thing. So I encourage everyone to go out and teach them, to read them, think on them, debate them, and get involved.
Great. Thank you, Nick. Our listeners can also listen to the Red Nation podcast available on iTunes. You talked a little bit about your future work. Obviously, it seems like we could talk all day if we had the opportunity. So I look forward to the prospect of having you back on. Thank you so much for all of your time today. And we'll have to stay in touch.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Have a good day.